To say that something is a circus is usually not a compliment, is it? This office is a circus means nobody's in control. Things are spinning and spiraling out of control and are chaos. You can't really get a promotion in the work world if you go up to your boss and say, "You know who you remind me of? You remind me of a circus clown." Generally not a good idea. There's even a meme going around on the internet when you are looking at people and feeling kind of judgmental about what's going on. You say, "This is not my circus and these are not my circus monkeys." You may have seen this on the internet. The case can be made, though, that Paul viewed the world as a particularly interesting kind of circus. Wild, untamed. Particularly, Paul seems to have, at least in this part of Romans, a very interesting view of human beings. Did you catch how many times he calls us circus-like? He says in verse 6 that humanity is weak. In verse 8, he says that humanity, us, are sinners. And in verse 10, he lets out all the stops and says, Christ died for us while we were enemies of God. It doesn't get much worse than that. I can't think of a worse term for human nature than that. Yet the good news of Romans 5 is that the circus is at every point on the compass. No matter where you go, 360 degrees, no matter where you go on this earth, it's a divine circus. That no one is superior to anyone else, and God is the one who is in charge of his 360 degree circus. God is in charge of the noise and of the scents and the sounds of the human circus. You see, the question that Paul is wrestling with in Romans 5 is this: how can God possibly deal with his people with any kind of justice and impartiality and equality when some people are faithful every Sunday and come every Sunday, where some are the once or twice a year kind of attendees, where some people have no faith whatsoever, where some good people never ever darken the door of a church, where some of the best attendees are small-minded and have a very tiny relationship to Jesus, perhaps none to speak of. They're most miserly and mean, yet they have the greatest seats in the sanctuary. Paul is wrestling with this very question. And Paul says that God deals with all people, because all people are his children, and we all have the same need. We all come from the same human place. We all come from a place of need, whether it's weakness, as he says in verse 6, sin, as he says in verse 8, or being an enemy of God in verse 10. The key to understanding our new relationship to God is this idea that sorts out the chaotic circus of human life. And that idea is the term that starts the passage in verse 1, justification by faith. This is something that perhaps you have to dig back a little bit into your memory banks. We teach this in Sunday school and in confirmation, but we don't talk about it a whole lot. But it is the foundation, in some sense, of the Protestant church, justification by faith. It's what started the whole Protestant Reformation way back in 1517 with Martin Luther. In English, unfortunately, justification isn't a really good translation of the Greek word. In English, we have this problem because what justification usually means finding a good excuse to do something. Oh, I forgot to call you back. I'm really sorry. I have to justify that because, well, I was having a busy day and I was on the road all day and I didn't write myself a note. And if I would have written you a note, I would have called you back.
but I justify it. That sounds like a good excuse. I justify my actions. Oh, I was late.
The reason I was late to work today, well, I got a flat tire on the way in.
Oh, I lost my temper. Well, that's true. I did lose my temper. But if you had to deal with him, wouldn't you too? That's how we normally use the word justification, as an excuse. The way that Paul means justification is different. Craig Kester,
professor at the Lutheran Seminary in Minnesota, says that we should think of justification in the computer sense. When you're writing a document on computer, if you justify a piece of text, you're making it straight. You're straightening it out. The lines are all over the page. If you justify, you bring in your margins, brings things straight up. Through Jesus, Craig Kester says, things line up and get neat. Through Jesus, God justifies us and straightens out this circus that we live in called the planet Earth. If sin is the term that Paul uses for relationships with God done wrong, then justification is the term for when relationship with God is done right, is straightened out. In other words, what is the length which God will go to straighten us out, to make right God's relationship with us? And notice here that what Paul is talking about doesn't rely on humanity at all. Paul acknowledges that right up front. We can't make the relationship right. Why? Because we're too weak, we're sinners, or we're actually enemies of God. We actually don't know what we need, and we can't fix it ourselves. And while we were too weak, while we were still sinners, while we were still enemies of God, God sends Jesus Christ, the Son, to die and to make things right, to justify them. So how does this work in real life? How does this work when it jumps off the page, when it jumps out of the Bible and into our lives? Rob was a circus worker way back in the 1980s. He was in a different town every few days, and working for the circus is hardly a romantic life. It's hard work, moving animals and heavy, heavy equipment. You usually take it down in the middle of the night so that you can make it to the next town, and you don't lose valuable moments when you could be performing. A lot of stuff is done while you and I are sleeping, and there's a lot of low pay. Many circus employees, to combat the loneliness, the chaos of the travel, like a lot of circus workers, Rob drank too much, he was hooked on pills, and he had done some other harder stuff as well. One day, Rob had a profound experience of God that made him get clean. And in a process after his conversion, he quit the circus to get away from all the easy access to drugs and alcohol and having different women in every town. His experience of God changed him and changed who he lived with and who he hung around with. Yet upon his return to his hometown, his old friends at home, it was not easy because his friends had not changed, and he felt that he had. One of his friends from a long time ago named Cheryl met him one night at a mutual friend's party where there was a lot of stuff going on, and Cheryl met him and saw Rob in the back corner of the kitchen. Rob had quarantined himself in a far-flung corner of the kitchen, chain-smoking, because he said, I can't be with all that. I can't be around that kind of scene anymore. It's much, much too tempting. And Cheryl commiserated with him for a while. And then Rob said this: the difference between them and me, though, the only difference, I think, is that I know how much trouble I'm in.
I know how much I need God to straighten me out. But them out there, he didn't use the word circus, but I certainly would. Them out there, they're numb to God through their drink and their drugs and through the zest and desire to only live once. The problem for Rob was that he was more comfortable before he became a Christian. Let's face it, he had numbed himself, but he was comfortable. But we know that once he converted, no matter how uncomfortable it was, no matter how painful it became, no matter how different his life was to the way he was living before he knew God, we know that God is working in that discomfort and in that moment of growth. You see, we Christians sometimes forget that God operates in those darkened kitchen corners and places of deep struggle. Too often we say that God operates in those wonderfully colored Sunday school lessons and wonderfully colored Sunday school books. And of course God does. But we forget that God really does work in darkened corners of this world, in difficult places in our lives, that God doesn't mind getting God's hands dirty. It's easier in the human circus to meet hate with hate, to meet arrogance with more arrogance, to justify our behavior. If you're looking for a justification to make excuses, it's easy to find it. Yet the very way that God operates is not in the hate, but in the love. God operates not on the screen of the hate sites on the internet or in me getting revenge on those who I think have wronged me. In fact, revenge is really just a justification, isn't it? An excuse for a way to act outside of social norms, to act outside of a socially acceptable way. That's what revenge, I think, by definition, might even mean. But God operates not on schemes of revenge and looking out for number one. God operates in reconciling love. God operates in ministries of anti-extremism in prison or in gang reconciliation in Los Angeles. God operates on people working together on bridging divides because Christ modeled that bridging of divides for us. First, human nature hasn't changed much in 2,000 years. People are still weak. People are still sinners. People are still enemies of God. I am still weak. I still sin. I still place myself as an enemy of God. Yet wherever ministries of love and hope seek to connect people and to heal people, God is there. Wherever ministries of love and hope seek to release people from imprisonment of addiction or hate, God is there. The good news of Romans chapter 5 is that God is active in this 360-degree circus. God hasn't just set this world off and then let it go like a little toy, and he just sends it down its way. A wind-up toy. No, God is active in moments of reconciliation and grace and love. For while we were yet sinners, Christ came and died for us so that we might have faith and that we might have life. Amen.